Sons of late-night dread, working up the courage to dial. Joey had gone bolt upright, her elbows ledging the table, darkly fascinated. "What's your name?" Evan asked.
"Benito Orellana. They have my son, Javier.
Where did you get this number?"
"A girl, find me. Her cousin is friend with my cousin's boy. She is called Anna Resian. She is from good Armenian family."
Evan had never, not once, conducted a nowhere-man call in the presence of someone else. Though he trusted Joey sufficiently to answer the phone in front of her, her presence felt intrusive. He wondered if this was what intimacy felt like. And if so, why anyone would want it. Evan said, "Describe her."
"She have the thin face. Her hair, it have missing patches. She is sweet girl, but she is troubled."
"Who has your son?"
"I cannot speak the name."
The deep voice fluttered with fear. "They kidnapped him?" Evan asked.
"No," the man said. "He has joined them, and he cannot get out."
"A gang?" A silence, broken only by labored breathing. "If you don't talk to me, I can't help you."
"Si. A gang. But you don't know this gang. Please, sir. My boy. They will turn him into a killer. And then he will be lost. I'm going to lose my boy. Please help me. You're all I have left."
"Sir, if your son joined a gang of his own volition, I can't help him. Or you." Beneath the words, Evan sensed the pulse of his own relief. He couldn't take this on as well. His focus was already maxed, the plate stacked too high. The seventh commandment, one mission at a time, blinked a red alert in his mind's eye. Evan pulled the phone away from his face to hang up. His finger reached the button when he heard it. The man, sobbing quietly. Evan held the phone before him against the backdrop of his wiped clean plate, the sounds of hoarse weeping barely audible. He blinked a few times. Joey was like a statue, every muscle tightened, her body like an arrow pointed over the table at him, breathless. Evan drew in a deep inhalation. He brought the phone back to his cheek, listened a moment longer, his eyes squeezed shut. "Mr. Orellana."
"Si."
"I see the location you're calling from. I'll be there tomorrow at noon."
"Thank God for you."
Evan had already hung up. He slid out of the booth, Joey walking with him to the back door. She shot glances across at him, her face unreadable. He pushed through the chiming door into the parking lot, the pre-dawn cold hitting him at the hands and neck. He raised the set of keys he'd lifted from the waitress's apron and aimed at the scattered cars, clicking the auto-unlock button on the fob. Across the lot, a Honda Civic with a rusting hood gave a woeful chirp. The waitress's shift had just started, which gave them 6 hours of runtime. Even so, he'd steal a license plate at the first truck stop they saw, from a vehicle boondocking in an overnight lot. He and Joey got into the Civic, their doors shutting in unison. She was still staring at him. He hesitated, his hand on the key. He said, "This is what I do."
"Right.
I get it," she said. "You help people you don't know." 26. How can you know you're real? Dawn finally crested, a crack in a night that seemed by now to have lasted for days. Evan pushed the headlights toward the golden seam at the horizon, closing in on Helena, in the passenger seat. Joey had retreated into a sullenness as thick and impenetrable as the blackness still crowding the cones of the headlights. By the time he reached the Greyhound bus station, a flat red-roofed building aperoned with patches of xeriscaping, the morning air had taken on the grainy quality of a newspaper photo. Frilly clouds fringed a London gray sky. He drove twice around the block, scouting for anything unusual. It looked clear. The three-state drive had served them well. He pulled into the parking lot and killed the engine. They stared at the bus station ahead. It looked as though it had been a fast food restaurant in the not-too-distant past. A few buses slumbered in parallel, slotted into spots before a long, low bench. There was no one around. Evan said, "They start leaving in 20 minutes. I'll pick one headed far away. When you get there, contact me as we discussed. I can send you money and IDs. I don't want your money. I don't want your IDs. Think this through, Joey. We've got 3 orphans and 15 freelancers circling. How are you going to make it? Like I always have. On my own." She chewed her lower lip. "These last few months with Jack, they were a daydream, okay? Now it's back to life." A band of his face gazed back from the rear view. The bruises beneath his eyes had faded, but still gave him the slightly wild, insomniac look of someone who'd been down on his luck for too long. "Listen," he said, "I have to honor Jack's last wish. I don't give a shit. Honestly, I don't need you." She reached into the back seat and yanked her rucksack into her lap. "What? You think I thought you were my friend?" She gave a humorless laugh. "Let's just get this over with." She got out, and Evan followed. She headed for the bench outside while he went in and bought her a ticket, a routine they'd established at the train station in Portland. He tucked $1,000 into the ticket sleeve and stepped back outside. She was sitting on the bench, hugging her rucksack. Her jeans were torn at the knees, ovals of brown skin showing through. He handed her the ticket. "Where am I going?" she asked. "Milwaukee." She took the bulging ticket. "Thank you," she said. "For everything. I mean it." Evan nodded. He shifted his body weight to walk away. But his legs didn't listen. He was still standing there. She said, "What?" Evan cleared his throat. "I never knew my mom," he said, "or my dad. Jack was the first person who ever really saw me." He swallowed, which was harder than he would have expected. "If no one sees you, how can you know you're real?" He had Joey's complete attention. He would have preferred a little less of it. It took him a moment to get out the next words. "Van Sciver took that from me. I need to set it straight. Not just for Jack, but for me. And I can't have anything or anyone in my way." She said, "I get it." He nodded and left her on the bench. He got back into the Civic and drove off. One distraction down. If he stopped only for gas, he'd make it home in 17 hours. Then he could hack into the laptop belonging to Van Sciver's muscle and follow where it led. Tomorrow at noon, he'd see about helping Benito Orellana. He still had plenty to do, and an unforgiving timeline. The Honda's worn tires thrummed along the road. The windows started to steam up from his body heat. He pictured Jack's writing scrawled there. "Get package." Jack's final words. His dying wish. Evan cranked on the defroster, watched the air chase the fog from the panes. He said, "I'm sorry. He's the best part of me." Again he remembered waking up in that dormer bedroom his first morning in Jack's house, the crowns of oak trees unfurled beyond his window like some magical cloud cover. He remembered how trepidatious he'd been padding down the stairs, finding Jack in his armchair in his den. And Jack's gift to him on that first morning of his new life. "My wife's maiden name was Smoke, with an A in the middle and no E on the end. Want that one?"
"Sure."
Evan screeched the car over onto the shoulder of the road. Gravel dust from the tires blew past the windshield. He looked for patterns in the swirling dust. Saw only chaos. He struck the steering wheel hard with the heels of his hands. Then he made a U-turn. He parked in the same spot, climbed out. A bus was pulling in, blocking the bench. For a moment, he thought she was already gone. But then he stepped around the bus, and there she was, sitting in precisely the same position he'd left her in. hugging the rucksack, her feet pressed to the concrete. She sensed his approach, looked up. "Let's go," he said. She rose and followed him back to the car. 27. Never been, and never was, and never will be. The man was ill. That much was easy to see. A tic seized his face every few seconds, making him shake his head as if clearing water from an ear. He'd once been a paragon of excellence, one of the finest weapons in the government's arsenal. And now this. He clutched a rat-chewed sleeping bag. Dirt crusted his earlobe. He wore sweatpants over jeans to ward off the cold. He jittered from foot to foot, then halted abruptly and screwed the toe of his sneaker into the earth, back and forth, back and forth. He was mumbling to himself, spillage from a brain in tatters, gray hair, gray stubble, gray skin, a face caving in on itself. Jack had come to Alabama to find him. But locating a homeless man was like trying to find a glass cup in a swimming pool. Hard to know where to start, and easy to miss, even when you're looking right at it. Yet Van Sciver had resources that Jack didn't. It had taken some time, but now, here they were, in the shadow of the freeway overpass. Commuters whizzed by above them, an ordinary Birmingham morning in ordinary motion. But down here, among the puddles and heaps of wind-blown trash, they might have been the last humans on Earth. Nearby, a fire guttered in a rusted trash can, the stench of burning plastic singeing the air. The man convulsed again, one shoulder twisting up, plugging his ear. Van Sciver reached out and clamped the man's jaw, the hand so big it encircled the lower half of his face. The man stilled. Van Sciver stared into his mossy brown eyes, saw nothing but tiny candlelight flickers from the trash can fire behind him. Van Sciver said, "Orphan Sea." The man did not reply. Around the concrete bend, Van Sciver could hear Thornhill shooing away the last of the homeless from the makeshift encampment. They were skittish and tractable, and had good reason to be. There'd been a rash of attacks against the community of late, a neo-Nazi group curb-stomping victims in the night, lighting them on fire. Van Sciver snapped his fingers in front of the man's nose. The man jerked away. The tick seized him once more, the skin of his cheeks shuddering beneath Van Sciver's hand. Van Sciver squeezed harder, firming the man's head. "Do you remember Jack Johns?" Van Sciver asked.
"I'm dead, orphan, dead man walking, never knew, never, never knew."
"Back in 1978, Jack Johns conducted your psyops training. 9 sessions at Fort Bragg. Have you been in touch with him since?"
"The woman's head like an open bowl. It was an open bowl, and I did it. Used to kill people for a living, you know. Used to kill them, and poof, I'd be gone, and no one ever knew. No one ever knew anything, never knew me. I never knew me, never did."
"Did Jack Johns ever mention Orphan X?" The man's eyes widened. His tongue bulged his lower lip.
"Don't know, don't never. He's a ghost. He's never been and never was and never will be."
"Do you know anything about Orphan X?" The man's eyes achieved a momentary clarity.
"No one does."
Van Sciver released the man, and he staggered back. Van Sciver knew from Orphan C's file that he was 57 years old. He could have passed for 80. The last medical tests before he'd retired and dropped out of sight had shown the beginnings of traumatic brain injury, likely from a rocket-propelled grenade that had nearly gotten him in Brussels. Since then, he'd deteriorated further, PTSD accelerating what the physical trauma had begun, taking him apart piece by piece. It made him unsafe, a glitchy hard drive walking around unsecured. "R," Van Sciver called out. Thornhill ducked back through a sagging chain-link fence and jogged over, sinew shifting beneath his T-shirt. He wasn't wearing his usual shoes today. He was wearing steel-plated boots. "I'm done here," Van Sciver said. "He's got nothing for us." He regarded the man again, felt something akin to sadness. "There's nothing left to get." The man's face seized again, and he tweaked forward, facial muscles straining.
"People taking and taking like bites, little piranha bites, until there's nothing left, until they've nibbled you down to the bone and you're dead. A skeleton held together by tendons, just tendons."
"I got this," Thornhill said, putting his arm around the man and walking him to the drain. "Come on, buddy. You're okay. You're good." The man shuddered, but went with him. Van Sciver folded his arms across his broad chest and watched. "I'm sorry you've had a rough time," Thornhill told the man. "It's not your fault. None of this is your fault. You can't help what you are." "Hell, none of us can." The man nodded sullenly, picked at the scruff sprouting from his jaundiced neck. Thornhill removed a can of spray paint from his jacket pocket, gave it a few clanking shakes, and started to spray something on the concrete by the drain. The man watched him nervously. "I knew a guy," Thornhill said, the sprayed lines coming together to form a giant swastika. "Loved dogs. Had a whole raft of them taken over his house, sleeping on his couches everywhere. Well, one day he's out driving and sees a sign on the road. Someone's given away baby wolves." He pocketed the can of spray paint, set his hands on the man's shoulders, and turned him around. Then he knocked the back of the man's leg gently with his own kneecap and steered him down so he was kneeling before the drain. "So he figures, what the hell? He takes this baby wolf home, raises him just like a dog, feeds it, shelters it, even lets it sleep on his bed. The wolf gets bigger, as wolves do, grows up. And one morning, just like any morning, this guy, he's building a shed, fires a nail gun right through his shoe." Thornhill tilted the man forward toward the raised strip of concrete running above the drain. "There you go. Just lie forward on your chest." He positioned the man. "So this guy comes limping through his backyard, scent of blood in the air. His dogs are all frantic, worried, can sense his pain, right? They're worried for him. But that wolf? The wolf doesn't see a problem. He sees an opportunity." Thornhill reached down, opened the man's jaw, set his open mouth on the concrete ridge. "So he tears out his owner's throat." The man was trembling, his stubble glistening with trapped tears, but he did not resist. He made muffled noises against the concrete lip. Thornhill leaned over him, mouth to his ear. "Because that wolf was just biding his time. Waiting, you see, for his owner to show the tiniest vulnerability." Almost tenderly, he repositioned the man's head. "No matter how docile it seems, a wolf will always be a wolf." Thornhill reared back to his full height, his shadow blanketing Orphan Sea. Thornhill firmed his body, raised one of his steel-plated boots over the back of Sea's head. Van Sciver climbed into the passenger side of the Chevy Tahoe, even with the armored door closed. He heard the wet smack. That was okay. Yesterday had given them a pair of solid leads. Sea had been the least promising of the two. On to the next. Van Sciver opened his notebook and peered at the address he'd written inside. This one held his greatest hope. Outside, Thornhill tugged off his boots and threw them into the trash can fire. Van Sciver removed his phone from the glove box and called Orphan V. 28. Her Version of Normal. In a McMansion in the impressively named and decidedly unhilly gated community of Palm Hills, Candy McClure strode through the kitchen wearing two oven mitts patterned with cartoon drawings of the Eiffel Tower. Classy. Her fuck-me lips, which would be her best feature if there weren't so many to choose from, were clamped around a candy cane. Sucking. She'd plumped them out further with lip liner and tinted gloss, which made things entirely unfair for anyone with hot blood in his, or her, veins. This was by design. She had more assets than the other orphans, and she was unafraid to deploy them. Contour-fitting Lululemon yoga pants and a muscle tank gripped her firm body, showing off everything she had to show off, while hiding everything she needed to hide. Such as the scar tissue that turned her back and shoulders into an angry, swirling design better suited to Pahoehoe lava than to human skin. She leaned forward and removed a fresh apple pie from the oven. It smelled wonderful. On the counter rested a bag of powdered sugar, a tub of shortening, and a flask of concentrated hydrofluoric acid, effective at dissolving flesh and bone. She was a domestic goddess. On the Easy Care quartz-topped island, her phone chimed. She flung off the mitts, leaned beneath the hanging copper pots, and picked up. Her boss's voice came through. Code. She glanced at the screen. Iridescent Motor, she said. My nickname in high school. Are you still undercover? Steam rose lazily from the pie. A lawnmower started up somewhere outside. Curlicue writing on her apron read, Kiss the Baker. She said, Deep cover. Target identified? She smiled, felt the peppermint seep between her teeth, cool and tingly. Yippers. She pulled her red notebook over from its place by the salt and pepper shakers, tapped it with a Pilot friction pen. The notebook held her extensive and detailed mission notes, and a new recipe for delicious shortbread cookies. For nearly 2 weeks, she'd been living here in this steamy slice of Boca Raton paradise, drawing the attention of the men and the ire of their wives. She'd been tasked with identifying who in the upscale community was on the verge of bundling $51 million in a super PAC opposing Jonathan Bennett. Ben Skyver had backtracked bank records and data comms and found that someone in Palm Hills had masterminded the operation from a rogue cell phone tower. Given that the negative campaign threatening to hit the airwaves was the start of a push for post-election impeachment, it was no wonder the mastermind was doing his best to keep his machinations, quite literally, off the grid. So Orphan V had moved into the neighborhood and was doing a suburban divorcee, hot-as-fuck, desperate housewife routine, renting the house for a few weeks as her post-signing of the papers gift to herself. She mingled with the denizens and took plenty of night walks, surveilling who might be in their backyard or on the roof, erecting or disassembling a ghost GSM base station. Last night she'd watched him through the slats of a no-shit white picket fence as he'd toiled red-faced over a tripod and a Yagi directional antenna. Neutralize now, Van Skyver said. I need you on X. Her expression changed. Orphan X always took priority. Something rang the cherries, Van Skyver continued. It requires your feminine wiles. Finish now. Get clear. Contact me for mission orders. The call disconnected. Time to clean up. She placed the notebook on the rotating glass turntable of the microwave and turned it on. Pocketing her flask of hydrofluoric acid, she cast a wistful gaze at the apple pie. She'd grown oddly fond of this house, and her time here in Stepfordia, nestled into real life, or at least a simulation of it, living among families, privy to their hidden resentments and petty squabbles. Yesterday, at the country club pool, she'd witnessed a disagreement over sunscreen application escalate into a battle worthy of the History Channel. She enjoyed her neighbor's small triumphs, too. Billy learning to ride a two-wheeler, a husband rushing out to the driveway to help his wife carry in her groceries, teaching the new puppy to heal. Candy had made a home here, a new wardrobe displayed on hangers in a walk-in, essential oils by the bathtub to soothe her burns, microfiber sheets on the bed, so soft against her aching skin. Satin sheets worked, too, of course, but they always seemed too porny. The microwave dinged. She removed the notebook and, on her way out, dumped it into the trash atop a confetti heap of apple peelings. She paused in the foyer, taking in the sweep of the staircase. How odd to have grown fond of this place. Was it a sign of weakness? Since Orphan X had inflicted the hydrofluoric acid burn on her, Candy sometimes woke up late at night, gasping for air, her back on fire. In those first breathless moments, she swore she could feel her deficiencies burrowing into her, seeping through her flawed, throbbing flesh, infecting her core. The sensation had worsened since last month. In an alley outside Sevastopol, one of Candy's colleagues had turned a beautiful young Crimean Tatar girl into collateral damage. Candy didn't mind killing. She thrived on it. But this one had been unnecessary, and the girl so sweet and lost. She'd come up the alley and seen something she shouldn't have. Right up until she was stabbed in the neck with a pin, she'd been offering to help. Her name had been Halia Bardaxia. She visited Candy in the late hours, her sweet, almond-shaped face a salve for the pain. She could have been 15 or 20. It was hard to tell with these too attractive for their age streetwalker types, but Candy had felt her death differently. Like a part of herself had died in that alley, too. A craven sentiment, unbefitting an orphan. She shuddered off the notion, turned her thoughts to stepping through her faux Tuscan iron front door. She loved heading out into the community. She got so much attention here. She stretched down and touched her toes, feeling the tight fabric cling to her, a second skin more beautiful than her own. Then she walked outside, putting on her best divorcee prance and twirling her tongue around the sharp point of the candy cane. The entire street alerted to her presence. The snot-nosed 15-year-old across the street rode his hoverboard into a tree. Long-suffering Mr. Henley swung to chart Candy's course to the driveway, watering no longer the begonias, but his wife's comfortable shoes. Candy reached the Rhino one-wheel motorcycle she'd parked in the driveway. Before putting on the helmet, she took the candy cane's length down her throat and held it there. She was good like that. She straddled the electronic bike and motored down to the club. It took a bit of balance, but not as much as you'd think. It moved at the pace of a stroll, 10 miles per hour. Whereas all the other orphans strove to blend in, Candy preferred to stand out. When people looked at her, they weren't really seeing her. They were seeing their fantasy of her. At a moment's notice, she could bind her chest, change her hair, alter her dress, and transform into someone else. And all those gawkers would realize they'd never really seen her at all. Right now, she was interested in creating an alibi, which meant being noticed. At that, she excelled. She parked the Rhino at the country club between a yellow Ferrari and the tennis pro's beleaguered Jetta. She unscrewed her head from the helmet and shook her honey locks free. The curve of the candy cane rested snug against her cheek. She produced the red and white striped length from her throat and got back to sucking. The towel boy did a double take, his jaw open in mid-chew, the dot of his gum glowing against perfect molars. An elderly foursome paused on the facing tennis court, the ball bouncing untouched between two of the partners. A trio of waddle-necked women sipping iced tea tisk-tisked to one another as Candy blew past. 3 seconds. 8 witnesses. Not bad. Candy entered the club, breezing by reception, and walked down a rubber-matted hall into the eucalyptus-scented women's locker room. She locked herself in the spacious handicapped toilet stall. A toilet stall that happened to have a window overlooking the back of the golf course's little-used 18th hole. She squirmed out the window, hit the grass silently, moved 20 yards behind the building to a familiar white picket fence. She hurdled it. She walked up to the rear sliding door, her luscious lips making an O around the stalk of the candy cane. Her target sat at a sun-drenched workstation off the kitchen. He was shirtless, horizontal parentheses of untanned skin delineating the paunch of his hairy belly. She leaned toward the glass. Knock, knock. She didn't want to touch the pane and leave prints. He caught sight of her and found his feet in a hurry, fumbling at the lock.
Hi. Hello.
Welcome, he said.
Wow.
She floated inside. Wow yourself. She glanced at his workstation, where two monitors ran stock price tickers, an endless stream of industry. A financial titan like him would have so many enemies, which meant so many convenient investigative trails. You're renting the house on Black Mangrove Street, he told her. She leaned close. You've been keeping tabs on me. He was sweating. She had that effect on men. Why are you in my backyard? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm delighted, but... He lost the thread of the sentence. She had that effect, too. She slid the candy cane out of her mouth. It's more private, she said, shaping her lips around the word, making it something dirty. He blinked several times rapidly. His own meaty lips twitched. He scratched at a shoulder.
Okay. That's nice. Private's nice.
A billion-dollar hedge funder reduced to a teenager at a school mixer. She placed a hand on his cheek, which was sticky with sweat. A breath shuddered out of him. He closed his eyes. She moved her hand up to his hair, grabbed his thinning curls, and tugged back his head. He gave a little groan of pleasure. Then she rammed the sharpened candy cane into his jugular. The first gush painted the monitors. Arterial spurts were always mesmerizing. He went down fast, hand clamped to his neck, legs cycling on the cool tile floor. Then they stopped cycling. She stared down at him. Dead people looked so common. She removed her flask, poured hydrofluoric acid into the wound, the familiar scent rising as it ate through flesh. That would take care of any DNA from her saliva. She crossed to the kitchen sink, dropped the candy cane down the disposal, and ran it, pouring in a dose of hydrofluoric acid for good measure. She picked up the cordless phone, called 911, wiped the buttons clean with a wet dish rag, and set it on the counter. The coroner would reach a precise time of death eventually, but why not help him out? She walked out the open back door, hopped the white picket fence, and jogged along the rear of the clubhouse, breathing in the fresh-cut grass of the golf course. She'd miss it, being here. Being normal. Her vacation had come to an end, but she had another gift to herself in mind. Catching Orphan X and making him feel every ounce of pain that she lived with day and night. She crawled through the window back into the toilet stall, walked out of the bathroom, turned left into the crowded gym, and mounted the stairmaster. Beneath her shirt, her ruined skin itched and burned, but she blocked out the pain. She'd keep at it for 2 hours, time enough for the cops to arrive and find Mr. Superpack back floating in a pool of his own blood. So many residents could say precisely where the fetching divorcee had been since the moment she stepped out of a rented house this morning. The gym was mirrored from wall to wall, and in the countless reflections, she could see every eye on her. After all, Candy could work a stairmaster. 29. End stopped. As they barreled along the freeway, Joey reached into the back seat to retrieve the laptop that Evan had taken from the headquarters in Portland. She fired it up, then flexed her fingers like a gymnast about to tackle the uneven bars. Evan glanced over from the driver's seat. "Careful you don't trip an auto erase."
"Yeah,"
she said. "I got it." He drove for a while as she clicked around. The late morning sun beat down on the windshield, cooking the cracked dashboard. A pine tree air freshener long past expiration spun in circles from the rear view. Above the speedometer, a hula girl bobbed epileptically on a bent spring. "Finding anything?" Joey held up a wait-a-sec finger. "This is some heavy-ass encryption. Can you break it?"
"I don't know."
"I don't know" isn't an answer.
"Thanks, Jack."
Her fingers skittered across the keyboard. It was like watching someone play an instrument. I'll tell you this, you certainly couldn't. Yes or no, Joey? There are maybe a handful of people in the world who could hack this, she finally said. And I'm one of them. But it'll take some time. And a fast internet connection. Van Sciver knows you're with me. So we have to assume he knows you can get to whatever information's guarded in there. He trained you. Please. I was better than him to begin with. It's the only thing I had growing up. We're talking 16, 18 hours a day online, checking out 2600, using the darknet and stuff. I put in lots of private IRC hacker chatroom time, too, like browsing the Chans, Vulns, and Sploit databases, fooling around with Scapy, Metasploit, all that. It was one of my selling points. Back when I was, you know, a wanted commodity. Before I was useless. She grinned and closed the lid. He knows I'm good, but has no idea how good. Once we hit L.A., I'll set you up in a safe house. I want what's in that laptop as quickly as possible. I'm going to require a crate of Red Bull and a Costco tub of Twizzlers. You'll have what you need. And Zac Efron. I want Zac Efron. Who's Zac Efron? God, you're old. She smiled, and it was like turning on a light, her face luminous. She observed him, observing her. What? I haven't seen you smile. She looked back at the road. Don't get used to it. As the Civic filled with gas, Evan scanned the parking lot and the freeway. Joey climbed out and stretched like a cat, slow and luxurious. Want any road food? She asked. Road food? Corn nuts, Slim Jims, Mountain Dew? I'm good. She brushed past him, heading inside. Don't leave me here. He looked at her. Why would I leave you here? She shrugged, not breaking stride. They were heading south on the I-15, Idaho, 10 exits away. Borders were always tricky. Choke points, easy to surveil. So far it had been smooth sailing, but so far hadn't been long. The gas pump clicked off, and Evan got back into the car to wait for Joey. Her rucksack tilted in the passenger side footwell. Another greeting card had fallen out. Evan leaned over and picked it up. A cartoon of a nervous-looking turkey against a backdrop of orange and yellow leaves. Fresh concern pulled at Evan. He opened the card. Sweet girl, I hope you have lots to be thankful for this Thanksgiving of your 16th year. Know that even though we're apart, I miss you and hold you in my heart. XOXO, M. Again, it seemed that Joey had read the card many times. Creases, wrinkled corners, a patch of ink worn off where she'd held it. Thanksgiving. Your 16th year. That was troubling. He set the card on her seat and waited. She approached, chewing gum, and opened the door. She spotted the card, hesitated, then picked it up and climbed in slowly. She stared straight through the windshield at the air pump. She smelled like bubblicious. Why are you going through my stuff? It fell out of your rucksack. Answer my question. There are more important questions. Like, who is M, and how did she have your address? What do you mean, my address? This is a Thanksgiving card. Thanksgiving was last Thursday. You were in the apartment Jack had set up for you, and Jack was in Alabama. No one should have known how to reach you. No one did know how to reach me. Joey, what if this is how they found your apartment? Look, I promise you, it's okay. Who is M? Scowling, Joey grabbed her hair in a fist and pulled it high, showing the shaved side of her head. Joey, we have to have total trust, or none of this works. She took in a lungful of air, let it out slowly. She's my mant. Your mant? My aunt, but more like a mom. Get it? Yes. She raised me until she couldn't, okay? Then I went into the system for a lot of years, until Van Sciver's guy pulled me out. How did she know where to send you this Thanksgiving card? Joey's eyes filled with tears. It was so sudden, so unexpected that Evan's breath tangled in his throat. She said slowly,
"It's not a risk, okay? I promise you.
If we have total trust, trust me on this." "They can track anything, Joey." She tilted her head back, blinked away the tears. Then she turned to him, fully composed. It was a different face, stone cold and rock steady, the face of an orphan. "I am end stopped there, completely end stopped." He stared at her a moment longer, deciding whether or not he believed her. Then he fired up the engine and pulled away from the pump. Evan's focus intensified as they neared the border. He kept it on rotation between the mirrors, the on-ramps, the cars ahead. He changed speeds and lanes. Meanwhile, Joey changed channels on the radio, responding with enthusiasm or disgust to various songs that Evan found indistinguishable from one another. Despite everything, she was still 16. A Hunter Green Forerunner had been behind them for a while now. White male driver, wispy beard. Evan pulled to the right lane and slowed down, timing it so another car shielded them from view as the Forerunner drove past. The driver did not ease off the gas or adjust his mirror, which meant he was either not interested or well-trained. Ensuring that passing drivers didn't get a clean look at them was no easy task on a 17-hour road trip. Van Sciver's people would be looking for a man traveling with a teenage girl. Not an uncommon combination, but not common either. The Honda's windows had been treated with an aftermarket tint, which helped decrease visibility. The sun was near its peak, turning the windshields into blinding sheets of gold, another momentary benefit. A truck pulling a horse trailer sidled up alongside them. Evan tapped the brake, tucking into the blind spot. "Hold on," Joey said, cranking up the volume. "Listen, this is my jam." He listened. It was not his jam. The horse trailer exited. He watched it bank left and amble up into the hills. At last the billboard flashed past. "Welcome to Idaho, the Gem State." While Joey bounced in the passenger seat, the Gem State flew by in a streak of brown. Scrubby flats, a few twists carved through hills, more scrubby flats. The gas needle had wound down to a quarter tank by the time he pulled off. The service plaza was at the top of a rise, a mini-golf bump in the terrain with good visibility in all directions. A single strip of parking lined the front of the plaza, which made for easy scouting. Of the vehicles, only a blue Volvo pinged Evan's mental registry, but when it had passed 20 miles back, he'd noted 3 children quarreling in the back. After he'd filled the tank, he and Joey went into the plaza, splitting up, as was their protocol. Joey drifted up the junk food aisle while Evan dumped 4 bottled waters and a raft of energy bars before the register. As the woman rang him up, he caught sight of his reflection in the mirrored lenses of a pair of cheap sunglasses on the counter display. The bruises beneath his eyes made him conspicuous, memorable. He snapped off the price tag, laid it on the counter, and put on the glasses. They'd be helpful for the moment, but he'd require something less obvious. He remembered Laura Lee in the elevator, how she'd concealed the finger marks where her boyfriend had grabbed her. "Just a second, please," he told the lady at the register. One aisle over, he found a cheap beige concealer. Joey appeared, pressing a bag of Doritos to his chest. She took in his sunglasses with amusement. "Nice look," she said. "Did you misplace your fighter jet?" "Don't worry. I'm getting this." He held up the concealer wand. "I'd asked to borrow yours, but I didn't figure you for the makeup type." "I wouldn't exactly call our last few outings makeup worthy," she said. "But you couldn't use mine anyways. I'm browner than you. Thank God." He headed back to the counter and laid the concealer and chips on top of the energy bars. The woman gave a smile. "Picking up some makeup for the missus?" "Yes, ma'am." She handed him the plastic bag. Joey was waiting outside, her arms crossed, staring through a patch of skinny trees down the long ramp to the freeway. "What?" Evan asked. She flicked her chin. A hunter green Forerunner exited the freeway and started up the slope toward the service plaza. 30. Do your business. Evan pulled Joey around the side of the building. They stood on the browning grass beneath the window of the men's room, peering around the corner at the travel plaza's entrance. A good vantage. That truck, she said, kept time with us for at least 40 miles. He thought of her bobbing in her seat, singing along to the radio. I didn't think you were paying attention. That's my superpower. What? Being underestimated. The men's room window above them was cracked open, emitting the pungent scent of urinal cakes. Through the gap they heard someone whistle, spit, and unzip. Evan set the shopping bag on the ground. They waited. The Forerunner finally came into view, cresting the rise. It crept along the line of parked vehicles, slowing as it passed the Civic. The driver eased forward, closer to the pumps, and stopped with the grill pointed at the on-ramp below. Joey said. Evan leaned closer to the building's edge, Joey's hair brushing his neck. They were 30 or so yards away from the Forerunner. Leaving the truck running, the driver climbed out, scratching at the scraggly blonde tufts of his beard. Cowboy boots clicking on the asphalt, he walked back to the Civic, approaching it from behind. As he neared, he untucked his shirt. His hand reached back toward his kidney, sliding under the fabric. He hooked the grip of a handgun, slid it part way out of the waistband. It looked like a big bore semi-auto, maybe a Desert Eagle. Not a law enforcement gun. The man approached cautiously, peering through the windows, checking that the car was empty. Then he let his shirt fall back over the gun and entered the travel plaza. He didn't see us, Evan said. Not directly. Not from behind us on the freeway. At best he could tell that we were a man and a young woman. He's trying to confirm ID. So what do we do? You don't do anything. I could handle that guy. He's bigger than you, Evan said. Stronger, too. In the bathroom, a toilet flushed, the rush of water amplified in the cinder block walls. A moment later, they heard the creak of hinges and then the hiss of the hydraulic door opener. A sunburned man waddled into sight around the corner and headed off toward his car. Joey snapped her gum. I could handle him, she said again. We're not going to find out, Evan said. Stay here. You're going into the plaza? Too many civilians. We'll let him come to us. He'll check the bathrooms next. Sure enough, the driver emerged from the plaza and started their way. They pulled back from the corner. Evan moved his hand toward his holster. Don't want to use the gun, he whispered. No suppressor. But if I have to... She completed the thought. I'll have the car ready. A crunch of footsteps sounded behind them. Was there a second man? Evan put his shoulders to the cinder block, flattening Joey next to him, and switched his focus to the rear of the building. A Pomeranian bobbed into view, straining a metal-linked dog leash. It sniffed the grass, its rhinestone-studded collar winking. Evan came off the wall. The little dog pulled at its chain, producing an older woman clad in an aquamarine velour sweatshirt. She frowned down at the dog. "Do your business, Cinnamon." She looked up and saw Evan. "Oh, thank God. Excuse me. Can you watch Cinnamon for me just for a second? I have to use the ladies' room." Evan could hear the driver's boots now, tapping the front walkway behind him, growing louder. "I can't. Not now." Creak of hinges. Hiss of hydraulic door opener. The woman said, "Maybe your daughter, then?" Evan turned around. Joey was gone. He tapped his holster through his shirt. Empty. He hissed, "Joey!" and leaned around the front corner. He caught only a flicker of brown-black hair disappearing through the men's room door as the hydraulic opener eased it shut. The woman was still talking. "Teenagers," she said. Evan stood at the corner, torn. If he shouted Joey's name, he'd give her away. If he barreled in after her, he could alert the driver and get her killed. As it stood, she had Evan's gun and the element of surprise. On point, he strained to listen, ready to charge. The woman misread his agitation, her face settling into an expression of empathy. I raised three of them, she went on, holding up three fingers for emphasis. So believe me, I know. It's hard to learn to let them go. The dog yapped and ran in circles. What with the driving and drinking, the woman said, making choices about their bodies. Through the cinder block walls, Evan heard a thud, a grunt. In the window just over the woman's shoulder, a spatter of blood painted the pane, and then the man's face mashed against the glass, wisps of beard smudging the blood. The woman cocked her head. Do you hear that? I think they're cleaning the bathroom, Evan said. Another pained masculine grunt and the snap of breaking bone. Deep cleaning, Evan said, as he shot around the corner. He shouldered through the men's room door. The first thing he took in was Joey facing away, her tank top slightly twisted, arms raised, shoulders flexed. He couldn't see her hands, but his Ares pistol was tucked in the back of her pants. The man was on his knees, his cheeks split to the bone, his front teeth missing, his chest bibbed with blood. One arm dangled loosely at his side, broken. The other hand was raised palm out, fingers spread. Evan took a careful step forward, bringing Joey into full view. She was standing in a perfect weaver stance, aiming the man's own Desert Eagle at his head, the long barrel made longer by a machined suppressor. Joey's finger tightened on the trigger. Evan held out a hand calmly, stilling the air. "Joey," he said. The man ducked his head. Blood dripped from his cheek, tapped the floor. The acrid smell of his panic sweat hung heavy. "Lower the gun," Evan said. "You don't want to cross this line."
"I do."
Her eyes were wet.
"I want to prove it."
"There's nothing to prove." The barrel trembled slightly in her grasp. Evan watched the white seams of flesh at her knuckle. "It's just one more ounce of trigger pressure," Evan said. "But it'll blow your whole world apart."
"What's the difference?" she said. "If I do it or you do it."
"All the difference in the world." She blinked and seemed to come back to herself. She inched the gun down. Evan stepped to her quickly and took it. He faced the man. "A directive came from above to have me killed. I want to know where it came from." The man sucked in a few wet breaths. He didn't answer. Evan took a half step closer. "Who's Van Sciver taking orders from now?" The man spit blood.
"It keeps us in the dark, I swear."
Evan shot a glance at the bathroom door. Time was limited. "How'd he find you? Are you former military?" The man tilted his face up to show a crooked smile, blood outlining his remaining teeth.
"Now that would give away too much, wouldn't it? But it's your lucky day, X. I can help you. I'll send a message to Van Sciver."
"Yes," Evan said. "You will." He shot the man in the chest. The suppressor was beautifully made, reducing the gunshot to a muffled pop. The man jerked back against the tiles beneath the window and sat in a slump, chin on his chest, head rocked to one side. 11 down. 14 to go. Evan dropped the gun, took Joey's arm, and walked out. No one at the gas pumps had taken notice. He flipped Joey the keys to the Honda. "Get your rucksack and the laptop." She jogged off to the right, and he veered left. When he stepped around the corner to check on the woman, she was bent over the dog, scolding it.
"Do your business, Cinnamon. Do your business."
She sniffed at him.
You know, there was a time when strangers helped each other."
"I'm sorry, ma'am," he said, picking up his shopping bag. "It's the teenager. Unpredictable." Her face softened. She returned her focus to the Pomeranian. Evan walked swiftly past the gas pumps to the Forerunner, which waited for them, motor still on, already angled downslope for a quick getaway. Joey met him there, climbing in as he did, tossing her rucksack ahead of her. She was still winded from the fight and the adrenaline rush, her clavicles glistening with sweat. He said, "You were a powerful young woman." He pulled out onto the freeway and headed for home. 31. Sprint the Marathon. By the time they arrived at Evans Burbank safe house 12 hours and 29 minutes later, they were driving a Prius with the license plates of a Kia. Bottle brush and pepper trees shaded the street of single-story mid-century houses. Evans sat apart at the end of the block behind a tall hedge of Blue Point juniper. When he'd bought it, one of a half dozen he kept at the ready. The neighborhood had been affordable, the houses charming if slightly ramshackle. But owing to Burbank's fine schools and proximity to the studios, the block's gentrification had reached a fever pitch. Now remodels perennially clogged the quiet street. He'd been planning to unload the place, and would do so as soon as he and Joey were done with each other. He maintained a labyrinthine and impenetrable network of shell corporations that allowed him to shuffle and discard assets without fear of being traced. He parked in the garage next to a decade-old Buick Enclave that had served him loyally. The garage door shuttered down, and then he and Joey were cocooned in darkness, safe. He started to get out when she said angrily, "What does it matter?"
"What?"
"Whether I kill someone." He took a moment to consider. "It changes you in ways you can't understand. You'd never be able to have a normal life."
"A normal life?
So I can, what, hang out at the mall? Go to prom? Take 1,000 fucking selfies?" Her voice held an anger he did not understand.
"Yeah," she said, "I'd fit right in."
"It's about more than that," he said. "We've talked about the 10th commandment, never let an innocent die. But maybe there's another part to it. Never let an innocent kill."
"I'm not an innocent."
"No. But maybe we could get you back there." She did not seem satisfied with that. She made no move to get out of the car. Sitting in the Prius, they stared through the windshield at nothing.
"I'm weak," she said.
Her face cracked, contorting in grief, a flicker so fast that he'd have missed it if he'd blinked.
"Why do you think that?"
"I couldn't pull the trigger on the guy in the duffel bag. I couldn't do it at the rest stop either."
"That's not because you're weak," Evan said. "It's because you're stronger."
"Then who?" He hadn't seen where the words were headed. Not until now. He set his hands on the wheel, breathing the dark air.
"Then me," he said.
For Evan, maintaining the safe houses was a part-time job. Every few days he watered the landscaping, cleared flyers off the porch, took in the mail, programmed the lighting control systems. Each location had what Jack called loadouts, mission essential gear and weapons. He entered the Burbank house, disarming the alarm system. The interior was dark, hemmed in by trees, the backyard shaded by a steeply sloped hillside. The house always smelled slightly damp, moisture wicking up through the foundation. Joey walked from room to room, mouth gaping. She came back into the living room, let the rucksack drop on the thick brown carpet, along with a bag of junk food he'd bought her at the last gas station. Twizzlers and Red Bull, as promised, as well as instant ramen packs, Snickers bars, and sandwiches in triangular plastic containers.
"You just have houses everywhere?"
"Not everywhere."
"Where do you live?"
"That's off limits." She held up her hands.
"Whoa, cowboy, I got it. X's place, off limits. But how do you have so much money?"
"When I was operating, they set me up with an excess of resources. They wanted me to have no reason ever to be heard from. It was a huge investment, but it paid well."
"Paid well?"
"How much is regime change worth?" Evan said. Joey pursed her lips. He said, "A well-placed bullet can change the direction of a nation. Tip the balance of power, so a country's interests align with ours." She shook her head, as if shaking off the thoughts.
"How has Van Sciver not tracked you down through your bank accounts?"
"He's tried."
"But you're too good."
"No. Jack was too good. He set everything up, taught me what I needed to know about keeping it untraceable."
"But things have changed since then."
"Right. I've refined the practices." After an unfortunate event last month, I diversified a little more. Bitcoin mining. She smiled.